This interview is of Becky Schaefer in her home on March 15th, 1988 in Jefferson County at 1419 St. James Court, Louisville, Kentucky, 40208. Becky, do I have your permission to tape this interview?
Yes.
And there has been an asking by Miriam Zena of the Jewish Hospital staff if she might have access to this interview. Is that all right with you?
Absolutely.
Thank you. This interview is for Kentucky Heritage Quilt Society. It's the Quilters on File project. And what we're trying to do is get some of the quilters that live in Kentucky to give us some of the information about their lives, what started them on quilting, and what they feel quilting does for them in their lives. We appreciate you being a part of this particular program. Would you please state for the tape your full name?
Full official name,
right.
Rebecca Ruth Schaefer.
And spell it, please.
The whole name, R-E-B-E-C-C-A, Ruth, R-U-T-H, Schaefer, S-C-H-A-E-F-E-R.
Thank you. And I've already stated for the tape where you live. Are you married?
Yes, I am.
And your husband's full name, please.
His name is Initial J. Scott Schaefer.
Does the initial stand for
something? For John, but he goes officially by Initial J. Scott.
Uh-huh.
A parental dispute, I think.
Is this Scott with two T's?
Yes.
Okay. And what is his occupation?
He's currently employed by the Chamber of Commerce of the City of Louisville, working for Destination Louisville, which is an organization that is aiding the transition of the headquarters of the Presbyterian Church from New York and Atlanta to Louisville, Kentucky.
How long has he been employed with them?
Since June or July of last year. He actually was employed by them before we moved out here.
Hmm. Moved from where?
From San Anselmo, California, which is just north of San Francisco.
And you'll spell San Anselmo for
yes,
us?
Yes, it's in Marin County, that's the first thing. That's M-A-R-I-N, and San Anselmo is S-A-N, capital A-N-S-E-L-M-O.
Okay. And what did he do there?
He had just completed 4 years of seminary training at San Francisco Presbyterian Theological Seminary.
Uh-huh. And prior to his studies there?
Prior to that, he had worked for a union that represents federal employees, National Treasury Employees Union. It's a union that at first had represented only IRS employees, but has branched out to other areas, for example, customs. And we had lived, before he went to seminary, we lived, in Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C., where he was director of organizing for the union for 4 years.
Where was his undergraduate work?
It was done piecemeal, and he ended up getting his degree from Antioch University, which has a program whereby you can receive your degree, which you pretty much write, no matter where you live. Although Antioch is situated in Ohio. So he received it in religious studies. He took some Greek and things like that while he was working.
Mm-hmm.
He just really had a few credits to finish up.
Uh-huh. Did you get a college degree?
Yes, several years ago, and in one of those ambiguous sociology/psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Were my double majors. I had been intending to, as a matter of fact, had been accepted in a master's degree program in criminal justice.
Hmm.
And the way that came about, I had been working at a state psychiatric institute when Scott and I lived in Chicago. So this was many years ago. And it was while I was working there that I also had a few more credits to pick up before I graduated. While I was working there, I realized that the psychiatric and the penal systems really were very interconnected. I was astounded at how many people would come into the psychiatric hospital who had just gotten out of jail and would leave the hospital and go into jail. And it was a seasonal kind of a thing. And I realized that both the psychiatric hospitals and the jails were attacking the same problem in our society, but from different viewpoints. And I was a little bit disillusioned with the psychiatric viewpoint at that time and thought perhaps there was more hope within the field of criminal justice. So then I decided to go back and finish up my degree, which was through University of Illinois Chicago Circle Campus. You know, isn't that funny? I think it was 72. Must have been right around there.
Is that right?
Yeah. And was accepted into the master's program through a different New York State at Albany, which had a very good criminology department. But right around the same time, Scott, who had just started working for the union, was given the chance for a very good job within the union out in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And San Francisco was like a Camelot to us. We had always wanted to go there. So I said, well, I can always go into a master's program, but I can't always go to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So we moved out here, or out there.
Yeah. Did you pursue the master's program then?
No, because part of what was going on with me at the time was that I had decided that we should start our family, or we had decided that. So,
When did you all get married?
In 72.
In 72. Uh-huh. And you do have children?
Yes, one daughter, Jenny Schaefer.
Mm-hmm.
She was born in 1978, and she has Down syndrome, and she's doing very well. She's 9 years old now, or 10, and reading, so we're very proud of her.
Were you aware before her birth that there would be Down syndrome in her history, that she would have Down syndrome?
No, although that we had had in our family a cousin who has Down syndrome, but it wasn't, he was born some 20 years earlier. And it wasn't until Jenny was born that we had all the geneticists do the tests and everything and discovered, in fact, there is a family trait in our genes that contributed to the Down syndrome. It's called translocation, which is a little different than the normal Down syndrome, but it's quite technical, so I won't get into it.
Yeah. Will she carry that?
Was yes, although Downs, gene? I don't think Downs people have ever had children. And there's some debate about whether that's just societal or whether they are in fact infertile. I don't know. So, but if should she have children, then yes, they would be Downs.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
But you didn't have amniocentesis or any workup beforehand?
No.
Uh-huh. Your book mentions two daughters.
Yes, we had a foster daughter living with us. 15 months.
And how old was she?
She was 9 or 10. She came from a very, very troubled background, born in Iran, and it was quite tragic. And so we had her in our house for a while until a proper foster home and proper schooling could be found for her.
Jenny was just a baby.
No, this was just recently. This was it was a year ago March that she left, so Jenny still refers to Nani as her sister.
Spell Nani.
N-A-N-I-E. It's an Iranian nickname.
Hmm. And she was an Iranian, full-blood Iranian.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How did you happen to take her?
She had, I'm not sure if you want this whole story.
Oh.
She had been in my daughter's class. And we felt she was misplaced because my daughter's class obviously is a special ed class and she did not look like anything was wrong with her, except she looked very, very shy, and she had a language problem, which we assumed was because she was Iranian and had been in the States for less than a year. But after some time with us, and a great deal of neurological testing, we discovered that, in fact, she had been brain damaged at birth, and there was quite a bit of neurological malfunctioning. Mm-hmm. So on top of the emotional problems that she had been through.
We need to get back to some of the biographical data that's expected for the quilters on file. And one of the things is we need to have, or we would request, the name of your parents.
Lois and Richard Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R.
And they're, are they alive today?
Yes, they are. They're living in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Do you have other siblings? Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I'm the oldest of, there had been six of us. I have a sister 2 years younger to the day who lives in Seattle. She's married and has two boys. And then another sister, also married with two boys, living in, well, right near Boston. And then I had had another sister who had died at age 30. She had just turned 30. She died of cancer, melanoma. She died 3 years ago. Yeah. She had been living in Guam with her husband, no children. And then I have two younger brothers, one of whom lives in New Orleans, and one who lives in Seattle. The youngest lives in Seattle.
Thank you.
None of whom are quilters.
Really?
Although several assorted artists.
I imagine they're intrigued with your work. Have you ever been employed outside your home?
Odd jobs here and there. I worked as a paralegal for about 2 years in San Francisco in the Pyramid Building.
Oh, really?
And other than that, temporary jobs and working as a psychiatric aide for 3 years. I worked in a bank for a while, a Japanese bank. I had been born and raised in Japan. My father was a missionary, and I spent the first 18 years of my life there. When I graduated from high school, the assumption was that I would come to the States on my own to go to college, and that I did. I went to Valparaiso University, which was a Lutheran university, which my father was with the Lutheran Church. And I went there for a year. I got sidetracked here. After I graduated, then I went or worked in a psychiatric hospital. Did a lot of temporary office help kind of jobs.
How long were your parents in Japan?
They were there for 22 years, I think.
Had all their children while they were there.
Right, all of us were born there. They had started out in China. They were missionaries sent to China, and they had just finished a full year of studying the Chinese language when this little turbulence in China broke out, and the American government said, okay, just to kind of wait it out, you can go either to the Philippines or to Tokyo, and they opted for Tokyo to
what
wait
were those
it
years?
Out, so.
Can you recall what years?
That was 48.
In 48?
Yes, that was
when
in
they decided to leave China mainland and go to...
The American government at that point, they had been trying to get all the Americans out prior to that in 47, 48. But by December of 48, they said, we will no longer have any responsibility for any U.S. citizens if you stay beyond this date. So they went to what was then an occupied Japan with curfews and the whole bit. They came in December. My mother said that she sat down on a curb and just cried that she didn't have any place to have her baby. She was having her first daughter. Yeah, and I was born a month later. Well, 2 weeks later.
2 weeks from when they moved from mainland China.
From, right. And there was a curfew at the time because there were coal-burning automobiles and trucks. And because of the fire hazard, there was a 6 o'clock or a nighttime curfew. And so when my mother started in labor, which was after dark, there were no cabs to take her to the Army Hospital, which is where she was going to have me. So she ended up calling a man who was Alexander Haig's driver, my mother was taken to the hospital by Alexander Haig's Jeep. And my folks just had their 40th wedding anniversary, and Alexander Haig wrote them a note.
Neat. Well, what about the education of your parents' children in a place like Japan? What was there for you? Was it a part of the missionary establishment? I mean, was there a school that had to do with the church?
There was a school set up. It was a one-room schoolhouse when we lived in Hokkaido, the northernmost island. And it was a very small and very religiously oriented one-room school. It was run by a Mennonite woman, and all the missionary kids went there. So I was the only one in my grade. As a matter of fact, I was 2 years older than anyone else from second grade. I had gone to a military school for first grade. So from second grade up through ninth grade, then I don't even remember what year that was. It must have been around 62. My folks moved to Tokyo, where there was a quite large American school there, American school in Japan. And it was like a prep school kind of thing. Not a parochial school. Embassy kids, business kids, missionary kids, and a lot of well-to-do Japanese families sent their children there to get an American education. And it was a prep school in that the assumption was that you would go on to college. And an incredible percentage, something like 98% of the graduates from the high school do go on to college.
We hear so much pressure on young people in their education. Did you feel that? A lot of pressure on you to excel and...
I suppose so. At the time, you think it's the norm.
Did you speak the language? Did your parents speak the
language? I did. My folks did, both fluently, and I did. And it's something that I still regret, that as I grew older, I lost a lot of my Japanese. I learned Japanese as I learned English as a child, so there was never any point in my life where I remember learning or having to study Japanese. I just grew up with it. But because as I grew older, went to more and more time-consuming American schools, I lost a lot of time with my Japanese friends, so that by the time I got to high school, I really didn't have many Japanese friends, personal Japanese friends left. And my Japanese suffered because of it, and now it's a real struggle. I can still understand Japanese, but to make the words come to my mouth is quite a trick.
Can you read it?
Very, very elementary kinds of letters. Although I was tickled, it was 2 years ago this month, March, that I was able to go back to Japan. 6 quilting teachers went. It was quite an experience. We were there for 2 weeks, and to be there both as an adult and to give back something when I had just taken so much from that culture was a really exciting thing. Anyway, I was excited to see that I could still read the street signs and the bus signs, train signs.
Did you find yourself being the interpreter for the English, the American cultures?
Although I was so emotional the whole time I was there, I don't know if I did any good.
That's exciting. How did that trip come about?
It came about through the organization that I still belong to back in the San Francisco area called East Bay Heritage Quilters. It's a very large quilt group. And they had a symposium 3 years ago, to which several Japanese teachers came. And the Japanese teachers, seeing the way the symposium was set up, decided that they would try to have a Japan-American quilting symposium in Japan. Quilting is set up very differently in Japan. Quilt schools, and very much like the judo jujitsu or the ikebana kind of flower arranging kind of schools, they aren't just evening kind of classes that you go to play around, but they're really very structured kinds of schools. And the schools don't work with each other normally. They're very, you follow one quilting master and study under her, usually a woman, although there's one man. And you learn that style of quilting and that style of learning, and it's usually a three-year program in which you are to produce so and so many master quilts each year in order to go on to the next step. In any event, a very highly unusual thing happened in that two schools came together to sponsor this Japan-American Quilting Symposium. And Anne Ito, who is a Nisei woman, or Sansei perhaps, meaning third generation American-Japanese, who still spoke Japanese, kind of arranged and selected for the Japanese teachers six American quilting teachers who she thought would be somewhat representative, and also who the Japanese quilters would appreciate learning from. So I was fortunate enough to be selected as part of that group.
Well, when they were making selection, did they know you had a Japanese background?
Anne might have, but I think it had to do more with the size of my pieces.
Mm-hmm. And the other women that went, what were their names?
Ruth McDowell and Judy Warren, Roberta Horton, Cheryl Bradkin, and Katie Pasquini.
I need some spelling here. You mentioned a class when you were talking about Ikebana.
Ikebana, I-K-E-B-A-N-A.
Is that one word?
Right.
Okay. And Annita.
And that her first name is A-N-N-E, and her last name I-T-O.
Okay, good. We'll probably come back to that. Thank you for the light. I wasn't realizing we were sitting in so little light. Yeah,
so dark.
Uh-huh.
But if you want to move here, you won't be sitting in your shadow.
Oh, it's all right. Thank you. I think this will help as far as the tape. Where were your parents born?
My mother in St. Louis, Missouri, and because for an American-born citizen in Japan, they can claim citizenship and statehood from whatever state from one of their parents was from. So I was able to be classified as a Missouri resident, even though I spent very little time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And my father in Cullman, Alabama, which is just north of Birmingham.
C-O-L-E-M-A-N.
Cullman. C-U-L. Cullman. M-A-N. Oh. C-U-L-L-M-A-N.
Thank you. And your religious preference?
Presbyterian.
What is your birth date?
January 3rd, 1949.
And your wedding date in 1972?
It was March 18th, the day after St. Pat's Day. We were in Chicago and we knew that we could not get married on St. Patrick's Day in Chicago.
I think we've covered where you went to school. What school subjects did you prefer when you were in, say, high school? What were you leaning toward as far as your thoughts of career?
Well, at the time I was going to go into nursing. In retrospect, it was simply because my best friend was going into nursing, and we grew up in a family that really said service and service-oriented jobs, and I just couldn't think of anything else. I didn't want to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. I wasn't quite as liberated as students are now.
And do I recall correctly that you had your first 18 years over in Japan, mm-hmm. but came over here because you completed high school?
Right.
But and that so doesn't mean your whole family came over
no,
here.
No, I came alone.
So how could you come alone? To whom could you come? Did you have grandparents?
Well,
I
had an aunt in St. Louis who kind of took care of me, but I was in a dorm situation, so. Mm-hmm.
How long did your parents stay over there?
In Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, this is where I get fuzzy. They stayed there, I think, 4 years after I left.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think of anything more on our notes that we need to cover on the biographical data before we go into the quilting. Is there anything else that you would like to mention that would be of interest about your time prior to you getting into quilting?
Just that I had talked earlier about working odd jobs here and there. And part of doing that was keeping enough time for myself to do handicraft kinds of mm-hmm. things, which leads into how I got started into mm-hmm. quilt making. I did mm-hmm. quite a bit, you know, back in the late 60s, early 70s of macrame and knitting and crocheting, you know, all that mm-hmm. sort of thing, mm-hmm. and sewing.
Had you always sewn? Did you sew as a child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, clothes and doll clothes, mostly those. Mm-hmm. My mother was a very good seamstress. And I think she had to figure out ways to keep four girls occupied, and so on a rainy day she'd get out needle and thread and get us excited about making things.
Did she make quilts?
No, she didn't. Her mother did. Not many of them, a few here and there. My mother is an artist. She's a watercolorist now, but she really didn't hone in on watercoloring until the past few years, but she always did a few things in oils or painting on silk. She always had an artistic bent.
Mm-hmm. And you say one of your brothers is?
Mm-hmm. He, as a matter of fact, went to the Art Institute in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
and did lithographs, although he's not doing too much of that now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did you learn to quilt?
Well, it was around 70, 71 where I first started doing a little bit of patchwork with scrap fabric that I had. And then after that, a sister of mine gave me, is it the Ickes book? Is that the?
Oh, I-C-K-I-S,
right,
Marguerite.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind
which
of
was
a
my
Bible.
First quilting book.
Uh-huh.
And after toying with that and playing around with some of the designs, I decided I really need to know a little bit more about it, but it wasn't until 72 when we moved to San Francisco area that I actually took a class.
And from whom?
Shelley Jacobson was her name. I don't know if she's still even quilting. I don't think she's teaching anymore. She did a 6-week class, and it was one of these general, 1 week we talk about patchwork, the next week we talk about applique, etc. And when we got to the section on drafting and patchwork, the week we spent on that, she said, now, I don't know too much about this, but if you're interested, you have to take a class from Glendora Hudson, who is the most superb machine piecer you've ever seen. So then I looked up Glendora to find out where she was teaching and took several classes from her. Glendora was formerly a math teacher at, I'm not sure, high school level, I'm not sure. And she approached her drafting and machine piecing with that same sense of organization and precision and gave me a very, very solid background, I think, in piecing.
How do you spell her first name?
G-L-E-N-D-O-R-A, Glendora. Hudson is H-U-T-S-O-N.
Thank you. How old were you when you started quilting?
Tough question. It was so 72 is really when I would officially, and if I'm 39 now and 88, I'll let someone else figure that out.
Well, we had what year you were born, but I don't remember it beyond that.
Right.
Is there anyone else that's quilting in your family right now?
No. My sister, one of my sisters has done just a minimal amount of it, but mm-hmm. I'm really the only one.
But there's no men in. This is Joy Peterson. I am recording Becky Schaefer in her home in Jefferson County, Kentucky, on March 15, 1988, for the Kentucky Heritage Quilt Society Quilters on File project. Becky, the question that was being worked on at that point was about men quilting. Do you know of any men who quilt?
Not personally. I've met Michael James, of course, who is quilt maker extraordinaire. But other than that, I take that back. I collect antique fabrics, and people have read about me here and there, and I got a very, very nice note one day from a man whose name is Arnold Savage from Ohio, and he explained his situation. He was a man who was very ill when he was young, and his mother set him to work cutting up and sewing together minuscule pieces of 1930s, 40s fabrics, and he asked me if I'd like them, and I wrote back and said, this is really nice of you, and so for the price of the postage, he sent me box upon box of 1-inch pieces of fabric, along with some pictures of his work, which was incredible. Full-size quilts with tiny pieces. So I do know him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's kept it up apparently, and had some shows.
Great.
From what I understand. Mm.
Do you think there's any difference between the way men quilt and women quilt?
I don't really know. I got my Quilters Newsletter magazine yesterday, and there was an article in the Meet the Quilters of a man. And reading that, it could have been. I think men have to overcome a little more than women do. Although what women have to overcome in quilt making is kind of what can be a negative. That's your hobby. I'm glad you have something to keep you busy. Kind of feel. And men have to overcome whatever negative kind negative onus or whatever,
yes.
In terms of a man doing what's traditionally a woman's handiwork, a woman's hobby.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think I was struck by that article because that same sense of being carried away by your work, just not being able to stop. And then, you know, at first there's a purpose to what you're doing. You're making a quilt for your niece, you're making a quilt for this bed, you're making a wall hanging for the hallway. And pretty soon that really disappears into just the joy of creating. You don't have any, you're just creating.
Right.
And that was reflected in that article, which I was excited to read.
Hmm. What were the quilts you made when you were learning to quilt?
Oh, I started out, the very first thing I did was a patchwork curtain, which was horrible. Just squares of fabric. And then I did several, maybe a half dozen kit crib quilts that ranged from embroidered to pieced, appliqué, this sort of thing. And then I went back to that patchwork drapery that I had done, which was in these absolutely neon turquoise, yellow, and fuchsia colors, and I made an Ohio star. So that really was crib quilt, and that was really my first real mm. quilt that was my own. So.
Did you tie them or quilt them?
Oh boy, let's see. They were quilted. Mm-hmm. They were quilted.
Was this after you had taken courses?
In between all that. It was when I transformed the drapery into a crib quilt that's when I knew I had to, because I started out piecing it by hand. And that's when I said, no, no more of this. I've got to take Glendora's classes. So it was happening simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have there been periods in your life when you were too busy to quilt?
Oh, yeah. Now it's one of them. It seems to go in phases, although as I've been more serious about quilting and as it's become a business, I really can't afford to leave it for long as a business. But also for me, on a very personal level, let me backtrack. Quilting for me has taken really two directions that sometimes mix and sometimes go their separate ways. And one is the business aspect of it, and the other is the personal creative aspect of it. And just within this last month, I had not been giving myself any time to quilt. We've moved into a new house, and it was really consuming all of my time, and I found that I was getting more and more depressed. And I didn't make the connection. And so one day I finally said, no, I've just got a break from this. I can't do any more, can't even wash dishes. So for 2 days I shut myself up in my studio and just played. And it was absolutely necessary. I felt like a different person afterwards. So I know now that the absolute importance that it has in my life. Yeah, easier said than done.
Mm-hmm. You've brought your studio home.
Yes, I have. I had when we first moved out here to Louisville, we lived in a furnished apartment in the East End, and it was a small apartment with a very enormous bathroom, and it was the only place that I felt I wasn't going to scratch up the furnished furniture. So I had my sewing machine set up on the vanity in the bathroom, and could not work, strangely enough. Sitting in front of a mirror just doesn't do it. So a friend of mine said, we've got to find you studio space, Becky. And she was wonderful. Marched me downtown, and she knew an architect downtown who had office space on 700 Main Street. And the office was on the third floor, but situated in the rear of the building, so there was an enormous room right off of Main Street. And through her, I was able to arrange renting that space. And up until last month, that's where I had my studio set up. So I was finally able to take everything out of the mini storage place and into that space there. But then because it's a new house here, or an old house that we've recently moved into, I was spending days upon days sitting here at home waiting for contractors, plasterers, heat people, electricians to call me back or for them to come make inspections, give me estimates. And I found I was spending maybe 2 days a week total at work. And that got too frustrating. So finally I regretfully made the decision that I had to move my studio into the house. So I'm here now, I'm happy about it, although I haven't worked out a rhythm yet between working in the house and doing my own work. It's a three-story house that we live in, and it's my dream that someday I'll be able to convert the third floor, which is currently occupied by a tenant, eventually use that space as my studio space. But for right now, I'm sharing space in the guest bedroom on the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's okay. It's not the best arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not able to do, because of that studio setup, to do any of the surface design, painting, fabric painting or dyeing that I would like to do. But other than that, it's adequate.
Mm-hmm. How do you think you might overcome that scheduling situation?
a lament in my life is to be able to create a rhythm somehow. I don't know. In the past couple of weeks, I've been able to have the rhythm of working on the house during the day and my quilting at night, but that's so exhausting. So exhausting. So when I do, both in terms of working on the house, stripping walls and painting, things like that, and in terms of my quilt making, I find that large blocks of time are essential. I can't work a couple hours here on this, a couple hours there on that. So I think the rhythm that I will probably establish is to work a couple of days on the house and then a couple of days totally in my studio without doing any housework, and float it like that.
That's fascinating.
It's also a dream. I don't think it ever works out that well organized.
That's nice to have goals.
Yeah, you're right.
Something to look toward.
So even though I'm working fewer than full-time hours, 40 hours a week, I still consider it my full-time occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of cheating on it now, it feels like.
Hmm. When you're actively involved in a quilting project for a long period of time, do you watch or listen to TV, or do you listen to the radio or tapes?
Radio and tapes. TV I find to be too distracting, that I tend to look at it, and that really is distracting and interrupts the flow of what I'm working on. But I listen to the radio, I listen to NPR, and I don't know the call letters yet, there's the stations here.
Mm-hmm. The National
right.
Public Radio.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where do you get your quilt designs?
That's a very hard question, because everything that I see influences me, but I don't know that, and I usually don't know where a quilt design or inspiration has come from until after the quilt is finished, and I look back and I say, ooh, look how much that looks like X. My starting point in working with fabrics is with quilts is always the fabric. So I don't usually sit down and draft out a design. This is both traditional and contemporary quilts. But I look through the fabric. I just rummage through fabric. It's kind of just playing. Just go and take out stacks and stacks of fabric until I find that what happens is, as I'm sorting or resorting fabrics, I'll tend to kind of resort a group of fabrics in a certain way, and I'll decide that, hey, they really excite me right now, or it'd be fun to play with those fabrics now. And whether it's the color or the texture or the design on the fabric, it just depends on what's happening now. But then those fabrics, that collection of fabrics, will usually dictate what type of quilt emerges. And that's almost down the line, my starting point.
A quilt that comes to my mind that I'd like to have us discuss, unless it's too painful for you, is Requiem. What was the genesis of that?
When I was in Japan, I had some money that I had put aside specifically for books, and some money that I had set aside specifically for fabrics. I really did not anticipate purchasing Japanese fabrics, because at the time I was living in California, and it was really trendy to work with Japanese fabrics, particularly yukata fabrics. And I had no desire to do that. I didn't want to pick up on a trend. But as I was in Japan, going to various craft places and stores, a Japanese flea market, I found that I was so drawn to certain pieces of fabric, whether it was like a ceremonial mat for a tea ceremony, or whether it was an old piece of kimono silk, or what were some other examples?
just a wonderful piece of fabric that I fell in love with passing a Japanese home furnishing store. And I just couldn't resist purchasing those pieces of fabric. And I'm sure that other people have had this experience where you go to a flea market or something like that, and then afterwards you lay all your treasures out. And I did that. We were staying in a hotel in Kyoto when I did this, and it was a tiny, tiny room with an absolutely tiny bed. And I put all the fabrics out on this bed that I had collected, and I was just shocked because they all went together. And I had no idea that I had been building a quilt, but they were all in, had some muted tone of moss green or a compatible kind of color, and all spoke of that. The Japanese word for it is shibui, S-H-I-B-U-I, I believe shibui, a quietness about them. And so I could not wait until I got home from this trip to start working on these fabrics. So that was the starting point. And when I started working on them, putting them up on a felt board on the wall, the first thing that struck me was in the one piece that I knew was going to be a central piece in the quilt, it was a piece of Japanese silk with a picture painted on it. There was a shape on it that reminded me very much of the geometric shape of the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. And I realized as I was putting the pieces together, I was simply putting them together as they would go. So dark would mesh into dark, or some line would be continued on the next fabric like that. That what was growing out of this quilt was a memory quilt, a requiem quilt. And it seemed so apropos because that the Vietnam War Memorial, as well as just thinking of kind of requiem for my childhood in Japan, that fit in totally to both the collection of fabrics and also to the mood that was building in the quilt. And I had had a Xerox, color Xerox heat transfer of my sister when we were kids in Japan. So that went in, and it fit in beautifully to the quilt. So that's how that quilt came about.
And when you were making it, did you know you would be submitting it to the Quilt National?
No, not really. Not really.
How did that come about?
Quilt National is something that I wanted to get into, and I had submitted twice before. And had been rejected, and I just wanted to get in very badly because I wanted people to know that I'm not just a miniaturist. I think that because there had been quite a number of articles written on me, not so much on me, but on my miniatures, miniature quilts, that people were not aware that I did other things. And so it was primarily for that reason. And also, it's a great affirmation, and I felt that I needed some sort of pat on the back to have me continue that line of my work, something very different. Because for me, I think that I've gotten very comfortable with the craft end of my work, and I feel very competent about it. But the art end of it is a totally frightening area for me because I don't have an art background. I'm totally a novice. I've taken a few design courses here and there, but if I have to think about design, it really throws me off base. I just get full of self-doubt. And so I have to work purely on an intuitive level when I'm doing an art-related creative thing. And it's very scary. It's very scary. Just don't have the self-confidence that you do when you know that you're doing a craft.
What was it? What was the sequence of events of getting into Quilt National? How does it happen? What do you do, and when did you learn? How long would the quilt be gone? Tell me more about
it. Okay, boy, I don't know. It took forever. I think that the submission was made in January of '87. Could that have been right? It's going to be touring And I was fortunate enough to be one of the quilt makers whose work is on tour for Quilt National. So it's in Japan right now, and yeah, I'm very excited about it because there's a perfect symmetry about it. My mother got a letter from a woman who she had known in Japan saying that she had gone to a magnificent quilt show in Takashimaya or some other department store in Japan, and lo and behold, she saw my quilt, which she had known about because she wouldn't have recognized my married name, of course, but she knew about because my mother had sent her a picture or something like that, anyway. So that was a very, very exciting thing to know that.
Yeah. And it's got the Japanese fabrics in it. Oh, how dynamite.
Yeah. And it's very Japanese motif. It's called tokonoma, I believe, and I'm not going to bother spelling
it. You've got to. I've got to write it up.
T-O-K-O tokonoma, M-A. Now, I may have the wrong word there. But in every Japanese house, there is a room in which there is a slightly raised, I believe it's about 4 inches above the ground, and then there's usually a scroll of some sort. And it's almost an altar kind of a feel, and they have a ikebana, a Japanese flower arrangement there. And it's very sparse, and very quiet. So the architectural motif around which I built the quilt that we were mentioning is as if it's the tokonoma, the room.
Right. Before we leave spelling, we need Takashima.
Oh, Takashimaya. I may be wrong about that department store. T-A-K-A, Takashimaya.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good enough. When I'm writing up, I have to have some spelling.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So back to the Quilt National, this isn't Japan so much, but I've really, really been tickled by the few, I haven't gotten a lot of responses to the quilt, but the few that I've gotten have been so moving. I received a letter from a mother who enclosed a poem that her daughter had not written, but had, I guess it was a penmanship kind of a study. The girl was 9 years old, and the mother and the daughter had sat down when the Quilt National book came out and had been looking at the pictures. And the mother wrote that when they got to my quilt and the mother had read the little blurb on it, the daughter said, "I know what that quilt is about," and ran out of the room to get a copy of this copy that she had written in school of a poem called Poppies in Flanders. Poppies in Flanders. If you'll hang on, I'll get that.
Oh, great, great, yeah. Quilt National.
In Flanders Fields by John McCrae.
And she said that's what that's about. So, do you want to read it?
I want you to read it.
So this 9-year-old girl, Susie Telsey, had written, or had rewritten, had copied this poem. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. I was so moved.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother had written, "I'm not sure what you had in mind, but I wanted you to know that your quilt speaks to many of us."
Oh,
which
my.
For me is probably the ultimate kind of response that I can get.
Yeah. I went to Quilt National and I did not know you. I did not know anything about you that I would ever meet you, but it was that quilt that I took the chair over and sat in front of.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. I sat there for 15 or 20 minutes while a friend that I went to Quilt National with sat in front of another quilt just so that we could absorb what we wanted to absorb. and that was my pick. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea I'd ever meet you, but it really spoke to me. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. I think we should say on the tape what Quilt National is and when and where.
Quilt National is held every other year at the Dairy Barn in Athens, Ohio. And it is a show, this last one was the third one for primarily contemporary quilts, or what some are calling now art quilt. It's a juried exhibition. There are usually under 100 quilts in it. Is that right? Did I get that right? The third year?
I've got a poster at home of Quilt National 79.
So 79, oh my.
Yeah, I've got that poster. It's got a Nancy Halpern on it. It's on the back of the door to my studio.
Oh, so,
And I think it has always been with the idea of it being contemporary. And
right.
I think Nancy Crow and Michael James were two of the instigators of it.
Yeah.
So
right.
I think that this was the fifth.
The fifth.
At least. Yeah.
And each time they have it, they're calling for entries earlier and earlier. So I understand the entry for the 89 Quilt National is already this September or October.
Yeah, well, don't they have to look at slides?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is the sequence? Don't you send a slide and
you
then they say,
slides.
Do they say they really want your quilt or they will judge your quilt among others to make a decision?
They say they will judge from slides, but after they get the slides and select, then they request that you send your piece in. And I think that that's a quality control kind of thing. They did not do that for the prior show. And my guess is that what happened was that when they received the entries, they were either substantially different from the photograph or the workmanship was really rather poor. So as a method of quality control, they ask that you send your piece in. I would suspect most of the ones that were sent in were
But it isn't
selected.
Assured.
Right, it's not positive when you get the okay on your slide.
But in order to publish a book,
mm-hmm.
they have to have them quite early.
Right, right.
In order to make those pictures, because they're not using your slides.
Right. No, they don't. And I don't know why that is. Because one thing that I have learned when you submit to a show is that the quality of the slides is essential. And also the way a piece photographs. I've now gotten to the point where if I want a piece, to submit a piece to a show, even if I have a piece that's better than the piece I'm submitting, if the piece I'm submitting photographs better, that's the one I'll submit. Did that make sense, what I just said?
Yeah.
So because so much is said in the slide.
How do you get your slides?
I have a professional photographer do it. I had an excellent, excellent photographer back in California, and I will never have a match to her. She, when she would photograph, she'd stop everything if she saw one piece of lint on your piece, and she would make sure that it was squared off within the quilt frame, things like that. The kind of exquisite attention to detail that most photographers don't have the time for.
How do you find one in the community?
I don't know. I have a referral now from a Pulitzer Prize winning photographer, I've gotten the okay to call him to get a referral, is what it is. But I haven't found a photographer yet that I'm real happy with here. What I was going to say about the slides, it's really kind of a shame in a sense because there are pieces that I really like that I'm pleased with that will not photograph well. Mm. I have a wool piece that's black with dark green and purple, and I love the piece, but it looks like mush on a slide. Greens do not photograph well. They turn very muddy. So that's a piece that probably will not be accepted.
Are you submitting this year?
If I am, the piece hasn't emerged yet.
Good luck.
I know.
What makes a good quilt?
Oh, that's tough. For whom?
In your mind, what do you consider makes a good quilt? for you?
For a quilt that I am pleased with. Is a quilt that captured me when I was working on it, that I wasn't, that kind of flowed, and that when I'm done with it, says something about something, about me, or about what I was going through. And for me, beauty is part of it. A sense of pleasure. That's a circular kind of thing. What gives me a sense of pleasure when I look at it? Mm-hmm. To have it feel balanced, that, you know, that somehow the design elements got right in it. Color is real important.
Why do you make quilts?
There's a Zen saying.
This is Joy Peterson interviewing Becky Schaefer for Quilters on File for the Kentucky Heritage Quilt Society on March 15, 1988. This is tape 2, side 1. And Becky, we were talking about why you make quilts. Could you go back to your Zen saying?
The Zen saying, I had it in on a tiny piece of paper in my old studio that goes, cucumber, unencumberedly cucumbering. I don't know what else to say after that. I do it because I have to, I guess. It's part of who I am.
Right. As a cucumber, you are unencumberedly cucumbering. Right. Nifty. Is this the same reason you made quilts in the first place?
Yes, I suppose it was, although it, yes, it very much was, and I'm kind of surprised to hear myself saying that, but as I had said earlier, when I did odd jobs here and there, but it was always the great thing that gave me joy was doing handwork. Although it wasn't really very creative at the time, it was doing something creative, making things. And I just did it for pleasure. Mm-hmm. And once I started doing quilts and realizing that I could do them fairly well, then it seemed to me that I shouldn't be doing much of anything else. So then the task was to try to find some way of making a living by making quilts, which is rather difficult.
And so now we're touching on the fact that you have published. Can we get into that a little more? How did it happen?
Sure. I'd been teaching. When I left San Francisco to move to Maryland, this was back in 1980. Right before I left, at that time I had been selling miniature quilts, but not teaching them. East Bay Heritage Quilters asked me if I would do a workshop before I left so that I could pass on what I had learned about miniature quilts to the members. And I said, sure. So that was my first experience at teaching. And remember I had said earlier I hated teaching, so that wasn't something that was part of my game plan as a child for a career. And I was pretty terrible at it. I mean, they had me on a stage and I knocked over the blackboard and I forgot what the words were, and, you know, so I couldn't say presser foot, I kept saying zipper foot, so I had this whole crowd of maybe 40, 50 women yelling out presser foot every time. It was quite disastrous. But then when I moved to Maryland, I think right at the same time I moved, I've always had been very, very lucky in that people are so intrigued by miniature quilts that they want to write about it. So I've had people who've been interested in doing articles write and then submit articles. And I've done nothing as far as publicity, but my publicity has come that way. So Jane Horn was the name of the woman who was really excited about doing an article on me and submitted it to Quilters Newsletter Magazine back in 82, I think, is when it came out. So it came out April of 82. I'm not positive of the year there, but I think that's right. It came out when I was in Maryland, and then I started getting calls, requests for teaching almost immediately. And after, maybe 4 months of rather poor teaching, I finally got in the rhythm of it and realized that it's not so much my teaching as much as just demonstrating and letting the work speak for itself. So I finally learned a way to have my my samples flow in an orderly fashion so people could tell how to do it. And I learned to enjoy teaching, but almost down the line at the end of the class, because there's an awful lot of information that gets thrown out in a class, someone would say, do you have a book, or are you going to come out with a book? And every single time I would say no, because my methods are not my methods, they're a compilation of other people's methods, and I really don't see any purpose in coming out with a book. Then moving back to San Francisco area, and one more time a freelance writer had contacted me to see about doing an article, and she submitted it to Creative Ideas for Living, which did something that I think is really not so nice, because they said, thank you, it's a wonderful idea, we love the idea, but we're going to put our own writer on it. So I'm hoping they paid that first freelance writer. In any event, they sent a photographer who was a fashion photographer out to the house, or to the studio. This was in San Francisco, and it was a beautiful studio space that I had outside of the home. And she spent a day and a half photographing me working. And because her background was fashion photography, the mood that she picked up on was really impressive. I mean, I thought, gee, I'd like to work in that studio. I'd like to know that person, you know? The photographs were very lovely. And the article that came out was a very nice article in Creative Ideas for Living, March of 86 now? And as a result of that article, I got over 3,000 pieces of mail. In the back of the magazine, they had asked me if this was okay, if they put in a send a self-addressed stamped envelope if you want more information in my address. And I said sure, thinking, you know, maybe a couple people would write. But everybody, I mean, I couldn't believe it, from, you know, Box 4, rural Route 1 in Idaho, and really obscure kind of places, not that Idaho is obscure, but wrote and wanted more information. And I think that the great appeal for them was quilt making, first off, but second of all, because of both time and space and money constraints, the idea of a miniature quilt just was perfect. And so the interest was there. And at the same time that all that was happening, there was a publisher, local publisher of quilt books, for whom I taught, C&T Publishing, and it's Tom and Carolee Hensley, that's a C&T. And Carolee, I had taught for her in San Francisco area, and she had said to me, Becky, if you ever are going to come out with a book, come to me first. That's the first thing that she said. I said, oh, I'm not going to do a book. And then she said to me about 6 months later, Becky, if you're going to come out with a book, now is the time. And I still just, I'm not a writer, so I really have no desire to. But then after the 3,000 letters, I decided, well, maybe it's time for a book. So when I returned from Japan, I spent that summer then solid working on the book.
Did you have someone else write it for you?
No, I was pleased at how it came out. I brought it.
I think it came out fabulously. I have underlined mine. It's so explicit. It's so well thought through.
Someone said, and I don't know whether to be tickled or horrified, but they said they could hear my voice when they read the book.
I was glad
about that. Yeah. I had gotten advice from several. I had every friend in the world read it over for me, and several of them said, you really need to come across a little more professionally, a little less chatty. Mm. But I
thought it was terrific. Can you spell Carol Lee Hensley?
Hensley is H-E-N-S-L-E-Y. Carol Lee is C-A-R-O-L-E-E.
It's one word.
Yeah. Although she goes by Carol. They're wonderful people.
Are they going to print it again, or are there
enough?
It's
in second print now.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Did you actually have some way of answering those 3,000 people? I mean, you didn't have a book.
I had put together a form letter that I sent out, and then said that I would then notify them that I was in the process of negotiating over a book with CNT Publishing, and when it came out, I would notify them. So that's what I did.
What percentage of people like that send you an SASE?
Boy, I don't know.
Were you on a lot of postage that first?
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, not very many.
Most do send an SASE.
Yeah, I'm still getting on an average of about 5 letters a day. And this is, 2 years later? Yeah. People who say, I'm just flipping through the back issues of Creative Ideas for Living. January is a big month for that. I got so many in January. I recognize that impulse to go back over your old magazine stack in January. So a lot of people have done that, and I got a lot of requests then. And it's usually the later people who don't quite understand the term SASE.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Someone just yesterday sent me $2 and said, if this is over what the postage is, have yourself a cup of herbal tea on it.
Oh, I love it.
I thought that was so sweet.
It's neat.
Yeah.
Which do you find more satisfying, piecing or applique?
Piecing. Yeah, I very rarely do applique. Just because the preparation time seems to be so much greater.
Do you always piece on the machine?
Yes.
Do you do any embroidery or crewel or cross stitch on your quilts?
A very, very limited amount of embroidery. I'd like to do more of that.
Now, Requiem has a motif that's repeated.
Oh, machine embroidered.
It's machine embroidered.
Right, and I've just started doing some more of that.
Do you enjoy most making the top or actually doing the quilt?
Oh, making the top. For most of my pieces, I have a quilter who does, not the pieces that are very personal to me, but in addition to making miniatures and these personal statement quilts, I make many, many crib quilts that are made of antique blocks that I've been collecting over the years. And those, down the line, I ship out to be quilted. There's a wonderful quilter, Janine Heisen. I never know how to say
her
name.
We're going to have to spell
it's
that.
H-U-I-S-J-E-N.
And
who quilts
Janine?
For me. And Janine. And she's magnificent. She is a wonderful quilter.
How do you spell her name?
Oh, J-A-N-I-N-E.
She lives in California?
No, she's in Michigan. And I knew that I could probably find, I hope my California friends don't get irritated at me, but better quilters back in the Midwest than I could in California, because I think the better quilters in California are just too busy doing their own things. Mm-hmm. So I put an ad in the paper and really asked them to submit samples, and from them selected Jeannie.
Have you met her?
Oh, she's a sweetheart, yeah. She's so good, though, that I'm afraid that she won't have time for other people's things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She's a young mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of extra income.
Not Amish or Mennonite.
No, she's not.
Mm-hmm. What makes a good quilt stitch?
evenness. Although I like small, but I, you know, that doesn't bother me so much. I was, if I could digress here.
Oh, do.
When Louisville Nimble Thimbles had a quilt judge come and talk about what's a good quilt, and I was, I think, the only one who walked out of there just so angry, because I felt so much, yes, there are some basics in terms of workmanship and craftsmanship that you have to pay attention to, but if you put that amount of energy thinking about the number of stitches per inch and whether or not your grain is all going in the same direction or not, you're not going to have time to think about what that quilt means, whether it even looks good in the end. And I think that he did a very, very great disservice to a great many of quilt makers in that group, because women who should have been saying, look what I did, isn't this fantastic, were instead saying about their work, oh no, I didn't miter my binding here. And it's just, you know, and downgrading themselves. And I think that quilt making is one area that women have that we can really be proud of. I mean, you can walk in someone else's house, or you can go to a potluck dinner, and down the line the women will say, oh no, it's nothing, it just didn't turn out quite right this time, and I'm sorry the dough was a little stiff or whatever. But they can really be proud of their quilt. You know, you take the plainest, most simple quilt block, and these women are bursting with pride. And I think that's something that quilting does for women that no other area of their life does.
Right.
And to have a judge, a male judge no less, denigrate that, I think is really, really awful.
It's really sad.
That's my own little soapbox there.
Oh, I think it needs to be said. Shouted from the rooftops.
Yeah, I was really quite upset. Haven't been brave enough to voice that yet.
I'm hoping that this recital has helped you hear it and realize how valid
yeah.
it is. I think it's great. Really needs to be said. When it comes to quilting bees and quilting parties, what do you think they are, and are they different, and what have you ever attended one?
Do you mean like quilt groups getting together on a weekly, on a monthly basis, or?
Would you call that a quilting bee or a quilting party?
I guess I would, just because in my own experience, I don't know of any other than when a quilt group has to get a quilt together for a raffle. That's really the only time. I think it's wonderful. I don't have time for it in my life. But a chance to sit there and work on a project together always is a source of power. It really is.
Have you ever attended a church-related quilting?
No.
Would you want others to quilt on your quilt?
Yeah. Oh, you mean a group?
I mean just a group.
No, I don't think so. I think I would feel I needed more consistency. Besides, my pieces aren't big enough for a whole group to work on them.
What quilt organizations do you belong to?
There's the East Bay Heritage Quilters and the Louisville Nimble Thimbles, and although I haven't sent my dues in yet, I hope to become a member of the Kentucky Heritage Quilt Pageant.
And you do belong to the National Quilters Society, National Quilters Association?
That's as part of Nimble Thimbles, right. Thimbles.
What about American Quilt Society? Quilter Society.
No. I've never been to that. I'm a little scared to go. They say it's such a big thing.
What quilt workshops have you attended?
Well, actually, I've never really attended one for myself, but as a teacher.
Have you attended any of, like, Michael James or Nancy Halpern or any of those teachers?
No, through if I'm teaching at a place and there's time for me to take a class from someone, then I'll do that. And I have taken a class from Nancy Crowe. This was many years ago. And in California, every January, they have a Point Bonitas, that's B-O-N-I-T-A-S, Point Bonitas retreat. At Nancy Halpern was there last, was it last January? Not this January, but the January before. And I went to that. I wish I could do more of that. I understand a group of contemporary quilt makers who get together somewhere here in the Midwest area, might even be Indiana, I don't know. But I'm most eager to get hooked into that.
You haven't considered going to Shakertown?
Oh, yes, I have. I think it'd be wonderful. Last year, I think it was at the same time that Houston, the quilt market at Houston was going on, so I was unable to. And this next year, I'll be teaching or doing a workshop in California in October, so if it's at the same time every year, I won't be able to do it next year, this year.
How many different seminars or workshops have you taught?
Oh, I couldn't even say.
Do we have any way of putting in the folder with your interview a resume or something that you have printed that we could?
I have a resume, but it doesn't include the teaching, because when you start writing down all the little workshops that you've done, it really starts sounding silly. Because for one thing, it's hard to draw the line between teaching at such and such a quilting 3-day workshop set up in Baltimore and the EBHQ Symposium and Northwest Quilters Conference. Continental Quilting Congress in Virginia, and all the stores that I've taught at, and then for the quilting guilds. So I think the most specific that I would want to be would be to say that I, since 1980, then have taught for 3 groups for the symposium workshop kind of setup for quilt guilds, when they will hire a speaker to come in and give a lecture and do a workshop or two, and then also for small quilt stores. So those are the 3 areas. I've never tried teaching on my own, and I don't think that I would want to do that.
What do you mean teaching on your own?
Where I would set up workspace in my house.
Oh.
and set up workshops. Or I would go out and rent a space and advertise.
With what regularity are you scheduling workshops?
Oh, it's very sporadic. It had been, I had been teaching every other weekend. My teaching is almost always on the weekend unless it's a local quilt store. So I had been teaching, which for the most part means being gone overnight every other weekend in California, and it was too hard on me, too hard on my family. So I had to slow it down, and now, because I feel so pressed for time, that I don't want my work time, my quilting time, to be spent on class preparation, because there's, for every day that I teach, I figure it takes 2 days of class preparation to get everything set up. I don't want 3 days of my quilting time to go into the class when I don't have any time to do any creative work. So I've really limited myself now. I taught this last weekend for the collegiate collecting show. They just did a few workshops. And let's see, I came back from a trip where I taught for 3 guilds and 2 stores in Southern California. But the next time I teach them won't be until this summer, July. East Bay Heritage Quilters is having another symposium. And then the following October, I've got a couple teaching engagements. But that's enough to keep me.
Well, if the North Carolina people asked you to come and work at their quilt symposium, then would you put feelers out in that area to try to take advantage of the time that you're
going? No, I know a lot of teachers do that, but I figure if I have to be gone 2 days, I don't want to be gone a third day, especially if half of that day is taken up traveling. And I know that that probably is probably more fiscally responsible, but I just can't, I don't have the energy usually to do that. I find it very draining.
What are the negative aspects of teaching?
The draining aspect that I just mentioned. For one thing, I'm constantly on. I have to be really alert to what the individual needs are of each student. And almost down the line, I will get a group that is as varied in their experience as can be. And for me to, I have to keep the expert quilters from getting bored and the novice quilters from getting terrified. It's a really hard balance to try to strike. So it's
you just always limit the number of people that will be in it.
No, I leave that up to whoever sponsors it. My stipulation is that each student have enough space in which to work and that the electrical needs be sufficient. But
so how many are there usually?
Usually 20-ish, although I've taught up to 40, and of course I've taught as few as 3.
Have you ever heard the term Kentucky quilt?
Yes.
What does it refer to?
Now that's interesting, because I could say either one specific quilt or a group of quilts, and I honestly don't know which. Which is it?
Some people think of it kind of like Appalachian quilt or Amish quilt. It's just a overall. But it's one of the questions that is something that they do want us to research. Do you have any quilt books?
Boxes and boxes before I put them on shelves and shelves, yes. I have a few.
What's your favorite one?
Oh, it varies according to my mood, but I still go back to the original, what I call reference books, Orlovsky's Quilts in America, and Bishop and Holstein's books. On more of a historical approach to quilts. I don't really appreciate the current flood of how-to books and specific project books, I should say.
If a person came to you as a beginning quilter, what would you recommend?
I don't know. When I had to do, you know, some extra research for that, for the references, further reading kind of thing for my book, and I couldn't come up with one how-to book. Because each book will provide different things. So I think that I had mentioned Michael James' book. His is a great general how-to kind of book. And then for an entirely different reason, Beth Gutchins, which I don't even know if it's in print anymore. But her book is just so readable. I don't know how it is on the how-to part of it. I still would recommend that a person take a class to begin with, or how to, rather than go to a book.
What quilt magazines do you take?
Quilters Newsletters, the only actual quilting one, but I also subscribe to American Craft Magazine and Threads and Fiber Arts Magazines.
If you pick one up at the stand other than those, what one would come to your mind?
Oh, I really don't.
Do you take patterns from these magazines or books?
No.
What do you do with your finished quilts?
Well, for the ones that I'm going to keep, which are the ones that mean something to me, I try to hang them, although I haven't in this house. But I try to sell ones otherwise. I haven't quite figured out what forum to to use to sell them, but East Bay Heritage Quilters had a craft show every year, and I really sold quite a few things through them, mostly miniatures and traditional antique fabriced quilts through them. So that was primarily what I sold. And I also sell through word of mouth. Mm-hmm. I don't really have an outlet or a gallery.
Can you put a monetary value on your quilts?
Oh, it's so hard. I had to do that recently for a quilt I submitted, show I submitted to. It's impossible. I can do it for the craft stuff because I know exactly how much money I put into it and how much time I went into it. I really keep very good track of my hours when I'm working on the craft things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the value that I put on the quilt is related to that, and also the rarity of the fabric and the condition that it's in. But for my other stuff, I couldn't tell you if it was worth 50 cents or $50 or what.
As far as entering quilt shows and contests and all, I suppose it's a little like your classes. You've entered a lot and gotten a lot of... Have you entered many quilts in the
shows? Yeah, I have. And again, it splits between my miniatures and my other work. And my other work, I really have been too scared to submit it to many places.
Scared of what?
Well, be